Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's other people's taxes. What Americans think about the Buffett rule. What Robert Zoellick thinks about leaving the World Bank. And Inside Foxconn, Day 2. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 12th of April. Good to have you with us. We'll get to that Apple story in just a second, but we start today with a different electronics company, one in a very different circumstance as it happens. And maybe the best way to set it up is to ask y'all this question. How many gadgets made by Sony do you suppose you own? Yeah, that's kind of the problem. The one-time standard bearer for the conglomerate known as Japan Inc. has lost money 4 years straight. A lot of money. Earlier this year, it announced the latest hit, $6 billion with a B in red ink. So this morning, the brand new CEO, Kaz Hirai, talked up his turnaround plan. Focus on this, downsize that, 10,000 layoffs. But what does it mean for the prospects for Sony and longer term for Japan Inc.? Marketplace's Scott Tong has that story.
The corporate name Sony has two roots. Sonus is the Latin word for sound, and Sunny Boy is a Japanese term for a young pioneer. Indeed, the company founders, here in this archive tape from 1950, were first in transistors, TVs, and audio. But now the CEO, Kaz Hirai, talks of returning to glory. He spoke this morning in Japanese. Here's an interpreter.
The world expects Sony to surprise them with attractive and innovative products and services, things that will represent Sony's return to glory.
The first step to that return is clear to MIT business professor Michael Cusimano.
First priority is to save the mothership, make sure the company doesn't go bankrupt. And then second, get back to being a leader in innovation.
Sony does lots of things. Finance, chemicals, medical products. But under Hirai, a core focus will be mobile electronics, phones, laptops, and tablets you walk around with, from the inventors of the Walkman. Here's Michael Levin at Consumer Intelligence Research Partners.
Their ability to kind of miniaturize and take advantage of mobile technology would be probably appropriate for them to try to do more with.
Of course, another giant brand already does that. It's based in Cupertino, rhymes with chapel. Sony is behind in virtually every big category. Take video on demand. Sony has a product.
The problem is consumers have never heard of it.
Analyst Sarah Rodman Epps is with Forrester Research.
Do you think about how much resources Netflix puts behind acquiring new content and acquiring new customers, promoting its service? Sony has put a fraction of the effort.
Today, Sony also talked up its camera and its gaming businesses. Notice TVs are missing. That division has lost money 8 years straight. Everyone can make them now, and profits are thin. And Japanese factory costs are high. It's a very rich country. Cusimano at MIT says another broad problem for Japanese firms in general is they look inward. They miss big trends.
They really missed the internet. All the Japanese companies missed that. They were just really focusing on boxes.
It's a tough story, but does this mean Japan in general is doomed? Not to Tokyo venture capitalist Yoshi Hori. He says there's an old Japan and there's a new Japan.
If you see from outside, you only see Toyota, Sony, and Honda. You don't see new Japan so easily because the new Japan tend to be more shine.
He says manufacturing, cars and electronics, is starting to yield to new sectors, e-commerce, gaming, clean energy. Where old line companies like Sony fit into that future is an open question. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Speaking of people's futures, college acceptances have been coming in the past couple of weeks, which means now might be a good time to start asking a couple of follow-up questions. Like, how big is my financial aid package going to be? Or how successful is a given school at actually producing graduates? Community colleges have taken a lot of heat on that last one lately, but they may be getting a break. The Department of Education says it's going to change the way it measures success. From the Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
The official graduation rate at Community College of Baltimore County is 9%.
And do you feel that that accurately reflects what you're doing there?
No.
Sandra Curtinitis is president of the college. She says that rate only counts full-time students going to college for the first time, not part-time and returning students or those who transfer to four-year colleges, one of the big reasons people go to community college.
It's an arcane formula that really has very little relevance to the mission of the community college.
The Department of Education said yesterday it's looking at counting a broader group of students. Wayne Burton helped advise the department. He's president of North Shore Community College in Danvers, Massachusetts. Burton says the change could attract more students and more support from states that often tie funding to graduation rates.
We hope that once we've shown how valuable we are, then public policy will shift and actually resources will come our way.
For-profit colleges also like the change. At the University of Phoenix Online, 5% of first-time, full-time students get a bachelor's in 6 years. Spokesman Rick Castellano says of all students, 31% finish in that time.
So that number needs to improve, and we're committed to doing that. But it's above and beyond the current Department of Education calculation.
Counting part-time students could backfire at some schools. In a recent report, the group Complete College America found that even with more time, part-time students rarely graduate. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, looks like the buyers are back. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. In Tunisia this week, there have been some of the most serious street protests since the revolution there more than a year ago. With revolution and political freedom, though, does not necessarily come economic advantage, Reese Ehrlich reports.
Dozens of Tunisians protest outside the town hall in Sidi Bouzid. 15 months ago, a street vendor burned himself to death here in defiance of the dictatorship of Zine al-Abidine Ben Ali. The uprising that followed was the first act in what became known as the Arab Spring. One of the demonstrators I met, Alawi Tahrir, says political change hasn't brought better living conditions or more jobs.
Nothing is being changed. We're just struggling the same situation. I have got a master's degree in English language, and I'm still unemployed for 5 years.
Tunisia's National Institute of Statistics puts the unemployment rate at around 19%. And those with university degrees are particularly hard hit. The governing Islamist party, Ennahda, says it needs more time to turn things around. Spokesman Saeed Ferjani.
We have to restructure an economy which has failed the people for more than half a century.
Ferjani says the government's only been in power for a couple of months, and constant opposition from ultra-conservative Islamists, as well as leftist unions, is slowing progress.
We cannot do it in 100 days. We need more time. And we need some kind of stability. Some of the people, they are trying really to stir trouble in order to not let the government succeed.
Ferjani says the government is encouraging foreign investment to generate jobs. It's accepted aid from the U.S. to cut its budget deficit. But Tunisians are growing impatient with what many here see as excuses. Unemployed protester Alawi Tahrir says the old dictator may be gone, but the country is still being run the same old way.
The system, the same system of Ben Ali is still running in the veins of this government. We want new blood, we want a new system, we want new things.
At least now, Tunisians have a shot at getting that. Parliamentary and presidential elections are scheduled in 1 year's time. But for many here, suffering chronic poverty and unemployment, a year may be too long to wait. In Sidi Bouzid, Tunisia, I'm Reese Ehrlich for Marketplace.
One of the higher-profile jobs in global economics comes open this summer. Robert Zoellick is stepping down as president of the World Bank. There's a three-way race to succeed him, but chances are way better than even that the job is going to go to the American nominee, as it always has. Whatever the political baggage of running the World Bank might be, though, there are some economic realities to deal with as well. Robert Zoellick retires the 30th of June. Mr. Zoellick, it's good to have you with us.
Glad to be with you.
You know, the global economy is obviously a much different place than it was 5 years ago when you took over the World Bank. I mean, developing economies are growing. Developed economies aren't, by and large, anymore. So why do we still need the World Bank? Why can't countries that need aid just go to the private capital markets, the ample private capital markets, and get what they need there?
Well, the financial crisis was one good example. In the past 5 years, developing countries have provided two-thirds of global growth. And obviously, you've got the Chinas, the Brazils, versus the very poorest countries, you know, those under $1,000 a year per capita income in 2007. And all of a sudden, you saw markets lock up. And you know, we did about $250 billion of commitments, and that was vital to keeping a lot of those countries going. And I think it's a mistake to see the bank as simply a financier. And you ask, well, why is that important? Well, the world's a better place, not only dealing with poverty, but frankly, those are going to be the sources of growth that help develop countries.
This is a little bit sideways, but do you guys suffer from being called the World Bank? I mean, it's not exactly an accurate nomenclature.
Yeah, in some of my speeches, I make a point. I said, you know, part of our problem is we call bank. And most people, at least until recent years, thought that banks' primary function was to lend money. And really what our role is, it is a financing role. And one of the things we've tried to do is use financing more innovatively. So, for example, I created an asset management corporation under IFC, our private arm, that taps sovereign wealth funds, that taps pension funds to help the private sector grow in developing countries. And we do very innovative things to help with insurance for hurricanes or earthquakes or other aspects in capacity.
You'll forgive me, and I don't mean this to be pejorative, but you saying that you're doing innovative things and what's that like complicated things with the financing that the World Bank does, it does remind you of what Wall Street did and what the big banks did 3, 4, 5 years ago and how we got into such trouble.
Well, we're still a AAA credit. we actually generate revenue that we plow back not only to pay the staff, but to focus on poor people. So I guess part of this is how you run the place.
You wrote in a piece in Foreign Policy not too long ago that developing countries are rightly demanding more of a say in how the global economy is run and, by extension, how the World Bank ought to be run. Why then should the United States still have such a great say in who gets to run the World Bank, who your successor is?
Well, the United States is between a 20 and 25% of the world economy. Now, as for whether the president be from the U.S., my view is actually that it's important for the United States to share some of these global responsibilities. And the way that the system has worked, you've never had an American who's head of the IMF, you've never had an American who's head of the UN, you've never had an American who's head of the regional development banks. So if it's not the World Bank, fine, but let's make sure Americans stay in the game too, because frankly, it's good for America and the world to engage in these institutions. And they help America.
Do you think the president's nominee, Jim Yong Kim, is the best person to run the World Bank?
I think all the three candidates are very well qualified. I've had a brief chance to talk with him. I've looked at his background. I like his sort of scientific method, and because there's no one-size-fits-all. You got to actually test results and back. So I think that he would be an excellent candidate.
Robert Zoellick, he's the president of the World Bank for another couple of months. Thanks a lot for your time.
Glad to be with you.
Coming up, tax the rich.
So the real challenge for the Obama presidential campaign as they're championing this rule is to tie it into the broader economy.
A Buffett rule attitude check with Gallup. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials jumped 181 points today, 1.4%, ended at 12,986. The NASDAQ up 39 points, 1.3%, 3,055. The S&P 500 picked up 18 points, 1.4%, finished things at 1387. Helping drive the Dow higher, shares of Hewlett-Packard processed a gain of 7.2% on word that personal computer sales rose unexpectedly. Financials did pretty well as well. Shares of Morgan Stanley steamed up more than 4%. Goldman Sachs polished up more than 3.75%. Today, energy stocks powered higher. Chevron fueled up 1.6%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.05%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up tomorrow, Friday the 13th. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the Consumer Price Index for March. In New York, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke speaks at a conference on rethinking finance. And it's a great day to celebrate grits. The World Grits Festival gets underway in St. George, South Carolina. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's fair to stipulate, I think, that there's little that's going to happen in the American economy the next, 7 months or so that's not going to be politicized somehow, rightly or wrongly, depending on how you lean politically. Exhibit A this week has been the Buffett rule, the White House proposal to raise taxes on those making $1 million or more. But as with all things political, what people really think is what actually matters.
And the latest poll number suggests
margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said.
Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief of Gallup. He's with us every week for an attitude check. It's our partnership exploring what Americans think about the news of the day. Frank, it's good to talk to you again.
Good to be with you, Kai.
So the political calculus that the White House is making with the Buffett rule is obviously that people think taxing rich people is a good idea. Is the White House right?
Yes, the two words I would use here are poll tested. we just tested it. We ask Americans, and the way we defined it, the Buffett rule per se was a minimum of 30% that had to be paid for all households making $1 million mm-hmm. or more a year in income. Now, actually, I believe the Buffett rule would be phased in for those making right. between $1 and $2 million, but nevertheless, that's how we shorthanded it. We found 6 in 10 favor it, a little more than a third are opposed to it. There was a Reuters poll last month in March, which found the same thing. 64% supported it. The month before that, an AP poll, 65% supported it. So there's no question that if you test the idea in isolation, it passes with flying colors.
Right. In isolation being the key phrase, right? Because nothing in this political economy in which we live happens in isolation. So where does this tax issue fall on the list of things that people really care about?
Well, that's the key. Those who oppose it, and that would be, of course, the Republicans and now the presumptive nominee Mitt Romney, mm-hmm. have to come up with ways to counter it, even though in isolation it passes. One thing is, and in answer to your question, perhaps, this is not the highest priority for the average American. The most important problem facing the country now continues to be the economy in general and jobs more specifically, and then the deficit below that. So the real challenge for the Obama administration, the Obama presidential campaign, as they're championing this rule, is to tie it into the broader economy.
Is it possible, Frank, that with the expiration of the Bush tax cuts coming up at the end of the year and this issue of whether or not taxes should be raised on people making $250,000 a year, forget $1 million, that the White House is sort of trying to prime the pump a little bit? I mean, how do we feel about raising taxes on people making $250 a year?
You know, that's very astute analysis, and I think that probably this is probably the leading salvo in this whole effort to argue on the part of the Obama administration that taxes should be increased on those who make more money. And when we've tested $250,000 or more, not $1 million, but $250,000, yeah. we still find majority support for that idea. So no matter how you phrase it, whatever you set the limit at, in isolation again, Americans yep. say, yes, that's not a bad idea.
And perhaps that's because the slice of Americans making more than $250,000 and certainly more than $1 million is pretty small.
That's right. Most yeah. of us don't make that much money, so it's quite easy when a pollster calls you up and says, what about the idea of taxing the rich? People say, sure. But again, I would reemphasize, Kai, that this is not the highest priority for the average American. And that's the real challenge that the Obama administration faces. How do you tie this increased taxes on the rich to the broader concerns of the average American, and that is goosing the economy.
Right. Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief at Gallup. The segment we do with him every week is called Attitude Check. If you want to know more about that partnership and the polling data from Gallup, it's on our website, marketplace.org. Frank, thanks a lot.
You bet.
Yesterday, our Shanghai correspondent, Rob Schmitz, introduced us to some of the people who make iPads and iPods. He took us inside Apple's Chinese supply chain, the carefully guarded and usually completely secret Apple supply chain, we should say. He got inside because the company wanted him to. After Rob's story last month exposing the fabrications of high-profile critic Mike Daisy, Apple invited Rob to see its production line at the Foxconn factory in Shenzhen. So today, part two of his story, which we should tell you, does come with a caveat that what you're about to hear was a tour arranged by Apple and Foxconn. Still, we thought the access was worth it. Here's Rob.
At Foxconn, Monday morning begins with roll call. Workers on the iPad assembly line listen to instructions from their supervisors. Then they suit up into white jackets and hats, pass through a metal detector, and within minutes, they're on the line. Each working group is in charge of one tiny part of the iPad, the chip, the motherboard, the battery, the touchscreen. There are dozens of workstations and thousands of people doing the same repetitive motion over and over. Their synchronization is hypnotic. And their movements are engineered to be as efficient as possible. At the end of each line, workers box up iPads as fast as they can. After timing several lines, I arrived at a very rough estimate. One new iPad every 2 seconds. It's believed that Apple makes between $200 and $300 off each iPad. If that's true, the people in this room help Apple make more than $10 million in pure profit each day. The workers don't say much about this, or about anything else. They've been working quietly since the start of their shift. The scanners at their stations, though, are talking. They say, okay, each time a step in building the iPad is completed. Everything here seems okay. But is it okay for the workers? I ask Louis Wu this. He's a special assistant to Foxconn CEO Terry Goh. He shows me a new machine that has replaced 28 workers. It assembles the iPad's motherboard with tiny, quick, precise movements.
So that's the direction where we're going, to try to take the boring job, the jobs that require a lot of repetition, basically away from the hands of the employees so that they can do something a little bit more interesting.
Wu says that means more workers will soon start operating machinery from computer consoles. He says Foxconn plans to make this transition without layoffs. Foxconn's been in growth mode for years. It started moving its factories to where China's massive labor force comes from, the country's poorer inland provinces. The wages are lower there, and workers can be closer to their families. But that hasn't stopped hundreds of migrant workers from turning up every morning at Foxconn's doorstep in the coastal city of Shenzhen. On this day, 500 people line up to apply for jobs. Ma Yunhe came from Hunan province, more than 1,000 miles away.
Until now, I worked in a state-owned factory, and it withheld my overtime pay. Workers here tell me that Foxconn follows the law and pays you on time.
I ask Louis Wu what Foxconn's looking for in these applicants.
To make sure that they can articulate themselves and they can understand instructions.
Okay, that doesn't seem too hard. Still, Foxconn's HR manager tells me that 200 of these 500 people won't make it through the application process. Lewis cuts in and gives some context on the labor pool they're dealing with here.
I was told that there are young kids coming over here. They have never flushed a toilet before. They have never taken an elevator. So if you don't tell them what to do, they will just wait there until the next elevator comes along. Even going inside, they don't know which floor they go up to.
To help with the transition, Foxconn set up a program that pairs new employees with more experienced ones in order to help them adjust to their new environment. Foxconn also provides amenities to its 250,000 employees that are uncommon at other factories in China. Basketball courts, tennis courts, Olympic-sized swimming pools, and a gym. Despite all these perks, Wu says Foxconn has always gotten a bad rap from the media. But he says he understands. Targeting Foxconn makes people pay attention.
Whom should I target? Right, it has to be Foxconn, because you are number one. So from that perspective, I can understand that. Right, of course, I would say it's not fair. But again, who said the world is fair?
But I tell Louis, it's not like these criticisms came out of thin air. Foxconn has consistently violated Chinese labor law and the overtime it asks employees to work. Workers did complain to me about supervisors who forced them to work when they're sick and treated them unfairly. And a recent audit by the Fair Labor Association revealed a host of problems Foxconn was asked to address to help make the factory safer. Wu doesn't deny this. He just gives context. For instance, the overtime problem. When a company like Apple needs to ramp up production by 20% for a new product launch, Foxconn has two choices: hire more workers or give the workers you already have more hours.
When demand is very high, it's very difficult to suddenly hire 20% of the people.
Especially when you have a million workers. That would mean hiring 200,000 people at once. Management problems? He says the average age at Foxconn is between 18 and 25, most of them high school dropouts from the countryside. When you have 22-year-olds managing 18-year-olds, problems will arise. The audit? Wu agrees with the recommendations.
We are not very good at communicating to the people who are working for us, especially for us. I think that's something we have to learn.
As a result of that recent audit, Lewis says Foxconn is going to make big improvements. He quotes an old Chinese saying, "Pushing up the height of the water lifts all the boats." In other words, Foxconn can raise standards for all factories across China. But doing that will require more money from Apple, from Foxconn, and if you buy Apple's products, from you. In Shenzhen, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
This is one of those radio stories where pictures really help. Take a look at the video that Rob shot inside Foxconn. It's on our website, marketplace.org. Click on Apple Account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, Mike and Ike are splitting up. The makers of the eponymous Fruity Chewy Candy has a new ad campaign coming out. They're going to separate the Mikes from the Ikes and sell them that way. But which one is which? We called Brian Ravel. He runs a Mike and Ike store at the Mall of America up in Minnesota. And we asked him if anybody there knew.
We don't, actually. They definitely like their secret private lives. They would never share their identities. So it's definitely ambiguous for a reason. So no, nobody knows their identities.
Oh, so much more than candy, I guess. All right, we got to go. That's it. That's Marketplace from APM. John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Sylvester Monroe, Betsy Streisand, Lisa Tucker, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.